I want to bring in Ian Tulloch of The Athletic, who focuses primarily on the Leafs, at Regress Ian on Twitter. And the Hanifin contract, I don't think necessarily correlates too much to Jake Gardner, but between that deal getting done and Ryan Ellis signing earlier in the offseason to an extension in Nashville, I just kind of wonder where we stand on Jake Gardner and a possible contract extension either during the season or next summer.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. And when it comes to the Ryan Ellis contract, I think if anything, that did the Leafs a favor considering how talented of a player Ellis is. And he seemed to take a very team-friendly deal, only a $6.25 million cap hit for, my money, one of the 30 best defensemen in the NHL. So with Gardner, what you're looking at is a guy who just put up a 50-point season. He was the minutes leader on Toronto last year. Anytime you have a defenseman like that, naturally they're going to command some salary in free agency. I guess the question you have to ask yourself is, are you willing to pay a guy like Jake Gardner about $6 million, maybe close to it? Because I have to think that's what he'd demand on the open market. Toronto has a lot of salary that they're going to have tied up in some of their best players, especially when Matthews, Nylander, and Marner eventually do get signed. So it's an interesting debate to have. I've talked to a bunch of fans about it who have different opinions on it. You can make a great argument for and against it, but I think at the end of the day, he comes in around that $6 million mark. On a team-friendly deal, maybe it's a bit less than that. But considering his point production, it just seems like he's due to make at least that in free agency, especially when you see what someone like John Carlson just signed for. Defensemen are going for a lot these days.
Hi, and it's Brent here. I think the thing about Gardner is the frustrating thing for me, at least listening to the dialogue around him in this city, is that if Jake Gardner played for another team, let's say he was a Blues defenseman, for example, isn't he exactly the kind of player that Leafs fans would be clamoring, hey, there's just 1 year left on his deal. We're in win now mode. We should be going out to get a guy like that. Do you not think he's a player who the Leafs would be looking to acquire if he wasn't here?
Or it's funny, if he was right-handed, he's basically Justin Falk. They're very similar players. They're guys who kind of struggle a bit defensively. They're excellent puck movers, put up over 50 points. And when they're on the ice, their teams consistently outshoot and outchance the opposition. Those are things you want in a player. Another guy I think of is Shane Gostisbehere in Philadelphia. If you watch him closely, he's not a perfect player. He has his defensive miscues. But he's a talented player who puts up points, he moves the puck, and he gets it out of the defensive end and into the offensive end. And at the end of the day, he spends most of his time in the offensive end. I know that we tend to think of guys like Gardner or Gostisbehere as offensive defensemen, but at the end of the day, if you're playing most of your time in the offensive zone, I think that's a good thing. I think that's what you want as a team. And I've always been a Jake Gardner defender. I've always been an apologist who tries to explain that, yes, you understand that he's a risk-reward player, and when he's on the ice, that he might do some things that really frustrate you. But on the aggregate, throughout his entire career, he's always outscored the opposition relative to his teammates. He's always outshot and outchanced the opposition. When he's on the ice, the Leafs are a better team. Is it worth $6 million for the next 6, 7, 8 years? That's another discussion. But I do think he's a very good player, and I do think he deserves to get paid. It's just whether or not you think that the Leafs have the cap structure to fit him in for the next 5 or 6 years.
That was going to be my question. With the Tavares deal now obviously on your books and contract extensions looming and probably coming in the next 12 to 14 months for Matthews, Marner, and Nylander, do you think that Kyle Dubas can make that salary structure work, or is Gardner kind of the type of guy who might get squeezed out a little bit?
And I think it might come down to just how good Travis Dermott is, because if Dermott has an excellent year, that weirdly might make Jake Gardner a bit more expendable, because you could run Riley on the first pairing, Dermott reliably on the second pairing, and then maybe you can use that extra cap space to help bring in a right-handed defenseman. Or the other thing you can do is maybe play Riley or Dermott on their wrong side, and that way you have Riley, Gardner, and Dermott all in your top four, all guys who can move the puck, put up points, do everything that you want a defenseman to do in the modern game. I think there's a way to make it happen, but at the end of the day, I think it comes down to whether or not you're going to keep Gardner or Zaitsev. If basically, when you look at their contracts, Zaitsev's making $4.5 million, Gardner's going to be making upwards of $5 or $5.5 million, probably a lot closer to $6 million. You can't keep both of them, and for my money, Gardner's the much better player, much better at driving results. It would mean that you'd have to trade Nikita Zaitsev, and then you have an even bigger hole on the right side when it comes to the Leafs defense. So if you're going to keep Gardner, you need to find a way to either move Riley or Dermott over to their wrong side, and you'd need a decent sample of evidence of it working. So I think you'd need to see some experimentation this season from the coaching staff. I know we haven't seen too much of it in the past, but I mean, with the talent they have on the roster, this would be the season to do it. I'd love to give you a perfect answer and say I know exactly what's going to happen, and yes, Gardner will definitely fit. But the reality of the situation is we just don't really know what's going to happen this season. Maybe Dermott plays the entire season on the third pair. We're not sure if he can move up to the second pairing. And then you have to re-sign Gardner because you don't really have anyone else who can reliably play there. So it's a tricky situation. I would love to see the Leafs find a way to keep him in if it meant moving out Zaitsev. But that's really what it comes down to. You can't keep Riley and Zaitsev and Gardner and Tavares, Marner, Nylander. Like, they just cost too much money. At the end of the day, you need to not pay some of these guys upwards of $5 million.
So I'm looking at Riley. He has a cap hit of $5 million, and the Leafs have a lot of big contracts to hand out. Nylander needs an extension. Matthews and Marner are going to be due. They just gave Tavares $11 million. Do you think Riley kind of being the team's lead D-man at $5 million kind of puts an internal cap on defensemen, or do you think that because that deal was signed so long ago, it's kind of outgrowing that cap hit?
And I hear what you're saying, and I'd love to see that. I know I've heard a similar argument about Tavares being at $11 million, that maybe that sets the standard for Matthews' next contract negotiation. That would be a great argument to go in it with. If you could get Gardner anywhere near $5 million, I think that would be a very team-friendly deal, considering what I think he's worth on the open market. I'm not sure if that's the case, especially I think the biggest thing right now is the cap going up. The cap has gone up considerably. It's up to $79.5 million, almost $80 million. When Riley's deal was signed, I think it was closer to $70 million. So if you look at cap hit percentage, which is what a lot of agents do when they're negotiating contracts, I think the Riley deal would come in closer to $6 million, or at least upwards of $5.5 million, which is what I think Gardner would advocate for. So again, I'd love to see the Leafs say, nope, no more than $5 million for defensemen. Jake, that's what you're getting. But if I'm Gardner's agent, I say, nope, I'll go to July 1st and someone will offer me a lot more than that. So we'll see what happens. It's difficult to say, but I think the one thing we do have to remember is that cap hit percentage matters a lot more than a specific cap hit when you're going back a couple of years on contracts that were signed a few years ago.
We're in conversation with Ian Tulloch. He contributes at the Athletic Toronto. He's also the host of the Leafs Geeks podcast at Regress Ian on Twitter. And Ian, you mentioned that the left side of the Leafs D is great. Riley, Gardner, Dermott, it seems like one of the best, probably in the top five in the league. And then you look over at the
right side. We don't talk about it because the Leafs defense is so porous last year. But if you just break it down by left side, right side, their left side is fantastic. It's their right side that was an abomination last year that really held them back.
Like, what kind of do you see formulating on that right side of the blue line? Is Ron Hainsey going to get a lot of minutes again, just sort of out of necessity because he can play the right side? Or do you imagine Connor Carrick, Justin Hall, the Ozhiganov, the Russian player that they signed from the KHL, could they be given more of a look? Or are we going to see a lot of Hainsey and Zaitsev in penalty kill situations and on the right side of the Leafs blue line this year?
So it's funny.
I think we
the similar issue of the fact that Ron Hainsey just shouldn't be on the top pairing. He's a good player. He's a great penalty killer. But if you look at his age and you look at how much he slowed down last season, the fact that throughout the course of his career, he's never really done well in tough minutes. He's played them. He's played tough minutes in the past, but he consistently gets outshot, outchanced, and outscored in those minutes. That's not what you want to see from your top pairing defenseman. You want to see them doing the outshooting, the outchancing. And I think Riley did a great job on the top pairing last year, considering what he had to work with. But I do think that you need to move Ron Hainsey down the lineup. So for my money, I would love to see Jake Gardner on a top pairing with Riley or Travis Dermott tried out with Riley. Just something other than the Riley-Hainsey pairing we saw last year, because it just didn't seem to work. With Mike Babcock, I'm not sure if we see that, just considering how much he trusts Ron Hainsey and how much he just loves giving him minutes, especially in tougher situations. But I think what would be best for the team is to try to find a way to get Dermott into the top four, because if you just think about it realistically, I think Dermott's one of your four best defensemen. He should get four of the best minutes on the team. He should get top 4 minutes. You need to find a way to make that happen. If you can slide one of Riley or Dermott over to the right side, then all of a sudden the right side of your defense doesn't look as bad. You could shift Hainsey back over to his strong side on the left side. And then your left side looks like Riley moves over to the right side. Then you have Gardner, Dermott, and Hainsey on your left side. And then on your right side, you have Riley, Zaitsev, and then whoever makes the bottom pairing, whether it's Hall or Connor Carrick. all of a sudden the right side isn't as bad if you're able to move one of those talented left-handed defensemen over to the right side. And I think unless a major trade happens, which I just don't see coming because those rarely happen in August or September, I think that the Leafs need to move a left-handed defenseman over to the right side, and I don't think that defenseman should be Ron Hainsey. That's who it was last year. That's who got all the big minutes playing in the top four. Not even top four. He played in the top pairing. He got 5 minutes a night in the penalty kill. I think you need to find a way to reduce his minutes, increase Travis Dermott's minutes, and just play your best players as often as you can. And if you do that, then I think there's a chance for the Leafs defense to be a lot better than people expect. It's just whether or not they try to optimize the usage of their players and basically play their best players on defense. That's what I'd like to see next year. With Mike Babcock trusting veterans as much as he does, I'm not sure if we end up seeing it. Only time will tell.
Well, that leads me into my next question, Ian. I would love to see that as well, but what do you think, whether it's Dermott or whoever, what do you think one of those young guys can do to prove to Babcock that they can handle that workload? Because it seems like experience is always the overwhelming factor, and it really has to get heavy-handed in the young guy's favor before Babcock will really notice what a player can do for him. So do you think there's anything other than just getting out there and playing minutes that these guys can do to convince Babcock that they can handle that workload?
Well, I know when he talks about Hainsey, he talks about some of the off-ice things that he brings, and that's what he likes so much about him. So maybe it comes down to the work ethic that they put in off of the ice. Maybe it comes down to their training regimen in the off-season. Maybe it comes into the way that they handle their teammates in the locker room. It's difficult for me to say from the outside looking in because I have no idea. I can only observe what I see on the ice. But when it comes to someone like Travis Dermott, what I think might earn him more minutes at 5-on-5 is if he does a bit better on the penalty kill, if he is given an opportunity to play, let's say, second unit penalty kill, and Babcock sees that he can trust him more in the defensive zone, that might lead to him getting some more opportunities at 5-on-5, say, in close game situations, maybe even protecting a lead in the last couple minutes. I know that last season he had Leo Komarov up in the lineup for a long time, but eventually he did come around and he switched the lines up. He moved Marner up the lineup. He took Matt Martin essentially out of the lineup and put him on Levo Island, just kind of left him in the press box for the remainder of the season and had Kasperi Kapanen come up and play in the fourth line. So I think there's a tendency to assume that Mike Babcock is an old school coach who, you know, doesn't listen to the analytics team and doesn't pay attention to the new ways that the game is evolving. But I think that there's evidence to say that he does. Look at the way that the team drastically changed from, I think it was January 24th. When they overhauled their lineup, they brought Travis Dermott in, they brought Kasperi Kapanen in, they ended up bringing Andreas Janssen in March. And in the playoffs, when Komarov was healthy, he played Andreas Janssen over Leo Komarov, which if you told me that in, you know, December or January, I would not have believed you because we know how much Babcock values his veterans. But I think if you show that you can play and you are willing to go to the dirty areas, and I guess what he likes about Andreas Janssen is just everything he is as a player, not just as a speedy, skilled player who can score, but the fact that he goes into the corners hard and wins battles. He backchecks. He's responsible defensively. If we see things from that like that from Travis Dermott on the defensive side of the puck, maybe that earns him some more minutes, and maybe that helps him earn a top four role this season. I know we'd all love to see it as fans because we see the talent that he has. I think it comes down to the habits and more of the, I don't know what the right word is for it, but maybe that grit, just that tenacity that Babcock loves to see in players. Maybe he needs to see a bit more of that before he trusts Dermott with a bigger role. But whatever it is, I'd love to see it because I think that he has the talent to play in an NHL top four, and Toronto's pretty thin on defense and they could use some help.
That's interesting. I was actually going to ask you if there's any reason to expect a bit of a regression from Dermott just kind of being exposed now a full year. But if he is a year stronger, a year bigger, if he was really able to improve in that facet of his game, it's interesting to see if Babcock will be able to trust him a little more. But I guess, like you said, only time will tell, right?
And I think the interesting thing with players is that we assume anytime we move them up the lineup that they're going to struggle. But all of the research indicates that the quality of your line mates are much more important than the quality of your competition. And what that means is basically whoever you're playing with has a much bigger impact on your scoring totals, on the rate at which you outshoot, outchance, and outscore the opposition. It's more important to your results than who you're facing, just because if you're playing with line mates for an entire game, that's 100% of the time you're spending with them, whereas you might only face first lines 40% of the time, second lines 30% of the time, third lines 20% of the time, and fourth lines 10% of the time. There's a lot more variation in who you're playing. And when you look at who Travis Dermott played with last year, his most common line mate was Roman Polak. And I don't want to get too hung up on Roman Polak. I like him as a person. I like all the work ethic he brought in.
Really nice
but
guy.
But he's not exactly a modern NHL defenseman. Yeah, he doesn't move the puck too well. There are a lot of areas of his game that you can point at and say, this isn't an ideal NHL defenseman on a playoff caliber team. If you give him a better line mate, if he's playing with a Riley, with a Gardner, even with a Zaitsev, who's a significant improvement on Roman Polak, I think that that can help mitigate some of the increase in the competition that he'd see. So even though we tend to talk about sophomore slumps, realistically, when you look at age curves, they tend to be more of a myth than anything. It tends to be we look at guys who had high shooting percentage years and then we're shocked that they don't repeat it. I mean, if you expect Travis Dermott to score at the same pace he did last year when given more minutes, that might be a bit of a stretch because his shooting percentage was a bit high when you look at the on-ice shooting percentage when he was on the ice. But if we're just talking about the fact that he played well, he was moving the puck well, he was controlling his gaps and looked like a effective transitional defenseman at the next level, I think if you move him up and playing with some better players, I'm not too worried about who he's playing against, because if you give him some guys who can work off of the skills that he has, who can work off some of the great passes he makes out of the zone, if anything, I think that helps him grow as a player. So I think it's always good to give guys a better opportunity to succeed. I think of someone like Josh Levo, a guy who thrived when he played top 9 minutes with Nazem Kadri, and when he plays with Matt Martin and Dominic Moore, all of a sudden he doesn't do so well. To me, that doesn't really surprise me, because if you're put in a good position, you're put in a position to succeed with good players, it's a lot easier to succeed than when you're playing with bad players. So with Travis Dermott, yes, there's going to be a bit of an adjustment phase to playing some of the better players in the NHL. But if you play him with some guys who can feed off of some of the talent that he has and work with him on the breakout, I think you're going to see some really cool things happen on the ice next year. I'm really looking forward to it.
We're in conversation with Ian Tulloch. He contributes at the Athletic Toronto, and he's the host of the Leafs Geeks podcast at Regress Ian on Twitter. It's Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, the Sportsnet Radio Network. Josh Goldberg and Brent Gunning. And Ian, I want to transition a little bit to the crease. And Freddie Anderson had a great year, I would say, in the end last year. Save percentage around 920, 38 wins. Goals against average a little higher than I'd like, but was a real workhorse, 66 games. Didn't have as many ups and downs, I feel like, as maybe he did in his first year in Toronto. But it's no secret that a lot of fans and probably a lot of Leafs pundits want to see less starts from Freddie Anderson this year than the 66 we saw last year. Do you think whether it's Garrett Sparks or Curtis McElhinney, somebody will step up to allow Freddie to maybe only play 55 games instead of 66, and do you think that will lead to just a blossoming into a truly elite goaltender?
And it's interesting because I think with the addition of Kyle Dubas as the general manager now being promoted into a new role, I think there's going to be a bit more of an emphasis put on to things like looking at how much fatigue impacts a goalie when it comes to the long-term save percentage on him. Because I know we saw Frederick Anderson do great last year, but towards the end of the season, if you look at his numbers in the end of March and in April, they weren't very good. And if you look at someone like Andre Vasilevsky, it was a very similar thing, a guy who was great throughout the entire season, Vezina quality. And then as he started to really feel that fatigue later in the season, his performance dipped a bit. It's tricky to say because save percentage is so volatile from month to month, from week to week, that it's difficult to really get a read on how much fatigue is impacting things. But I think we've realized in the modern day that you don't want your goaltender playing 70-plus games. You know, that we're long past the days of Martin Brodeur playing almost a full season and the backup not really doing much. I think in the modern game, you want to have your goaltender, like you said, playing about 55 to 60 games, your backup getting at least 20 to 25 games in the crease. And with Frederick Anderson over the last 2 years, we haven't seen that. 66 games played in the regular season the past 2 years. If you throw in the playoff games that he's played, that's 72 plus 73. That's almost 150 starts over the past 2 years for Frederick Anderson, and that's not even including preseason or World Cup of Hockey play. That's a lot of time going down to the butterfly, going post to post. The stress on goalies' knees and the stress on their groin, it's the reason that they tend to age out a lot faster than most players, and it's the reason that when you're playing 60-plus games in the regular season, going down hard in your knees, hard in your groin, it's the reason that by about age 32, age 33, a lot of goalies are done. And with Frederick Anderson, he's 28 years old. He's still pretty young from goaltender standpoint, but I agree with you. I think that he needs to get less starts next year if you're going to ride him into the playoffs. I think when you look at basketball, what teams try to do is they try to make sure that their players are peaking at the right time. I like to think of the San Antonio Spurs or the Golden State Warriors. If you have an older player on your roster, or let's just say a really good player who you want to make sure is ready for the playoffs, you rest him every so often. You look at Tim Duncan, he sat out on back-to-back nights. He sat out whenever the team had 3 games in 5 nights. And they made sure that by the time the playoffs came around, Tim Duncan was at 100%. He was at his peak physical conditioning. With the Leafs, it was almost the opposite last year. You know, as the season went on, Frederik Andersen played more back-to-backs. As the season went on, Ron Hainsey just seemed to get more minutes. And then by the time they got to the playoffs, they were gassed. I think this season, I'd love to see them, you know, get more rest, take more games off. You have Garrett Sparks, who I think is ready to prove that he can play in the NHL. And if not him, you have Curtis McIlhenny, who put out one of the best seasons from a backup goaltending NHL goaltender last year. Play them 25-plus games. You're a team that's easily going to make the playoffs with the roster that you have, so why not give your goaltender a bit more rest so that when it comes time for the playoffs, he's not at 80 or 90%. He's at 100%. He's ready to go, and he's ready to give you the 20 games that you might need if you're going to make a run.
All right, Ian, I was going to ask you who you like between McIlhenny and Sparks, but you just kind of leaned into it there, so we'll end on this. William Nylander, we're still waiting on the extension. What does it look like? What should it look like when the Leafs sign him up? Long-term, short-term, what does the best deal for both parties look like?
And it's interesting. I think the two comparables that you look at are the contracts that have been signed recently. David Pastrnak and Nikolaj Ehlers, both from the same draft class. I mean, David Pastrnak played on the same team as Nylander back when they were in Sweden together. Pastrnak signed a six-year deal at 6.66, which kicked in last year. Ehlers' deal, which a lot of people don't realize, actually kicks in this year. Last year, he played on his ELC, and his extension kicks in this year, much like Nylander's will. Ehlers is locked in on a six-year deal at $6 million, and Pastrnak's making about 6.7 mil, let's call it. I don't like getting into too many decimals. Pastrnak's clearly the better player when you look at point production, and he has a much better reason to say that he deserves that money. If you prorate that to the current cap, the current $79.5 million cap, just based on cap hit percentage, Pastrnak comes in at about $7 million, whereas Ehlers comes in at $6 million. I think that Nylander's point production has been very similar to Ehlers over that time, and if you're the Leafs, you're arguing that that's what he's worth. He's worth the Ehlers contract. He's worth a six-year deal at $6 million. If you're in Nylander's camp, you're saying, no, he's worth Pastrnak money. He's worth that percentage of the cap. He's worth $7 million over that deal. I think maybe they come in somewhere in the middle, around $6.5 million. And what it really comes down to is it comes down to how much term there is. Because on a six-year deal, for fun, let's say he's worth $6.5 million on a six-year deal. If the Leafs want to go 7 or 8 years, that's going to cost them more money because then you start getting into unrestricted free agency years. Those are years where if Nylander was on the open market, he'd be able to sign anywhere as a UFA. So those years are worth a lot because as a player, you have a lot more leverage to earn more money. So if you're going to lock him up for 6 years, let's say it's $6.5 million. If you're going to lock him up to, let's say, 8 years, then the average annual value probably moves up closer to $7 million. So it depends how long he's looking to sign. If he signs an eight-year deal, I'd imagine it's in the $7 million range. If he signs a six-year deal, I'd imagine it's in around the $6.5 million range. And I really don't think he's going to sign a bridge deal. I've heard some arguments for and against it, but it just seems like this is a player they want to lock up long-term. So I'm going to guess around $6.5 million, but don't be surprised if it's closer to $7 million, especially if they go with the eight-year term.
Ian, we appreciate your time, man. Always great insight from you, and hope to talk to you throughout what should be a very exciting for Leafs Nation this year.
Looking forward to it. Thanks a lot for having me, guys.
That is Ian Tulloch, contributor at The Athletic, host of the Leafs Geeks podcast, at Regress Ian on Twitter.